Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Austin.
We're doing a little bit of a bumper on this episode because in the past couple days, a lot of stuff has come to light. We were talking about victims of abuse and harassment coming forward in the queer romance industry. And this episode was recorded about 2 weeks ago, and it's going up tomorrow, and we just didn't want it to go out without some kind of statement of support for the victims. We're not going to go super in-depth, but we'll link to stuff in the episode notes. But this is concerning Santino Hassel, who seems to have abused and harassed a lot of people, as well as the now former editorial director at Riptide Publishing, Sarah Lyons. And I realized when we were talking about this, also the author Tristina Wright, I think a couple weeks ago, also harassing readers. So a whole lot of it's been a couple days, a couple weeks, and we just really wanted to say we support you and we believe you to the victims, and this fucking sucks.
Yeah, it's brutal. We don't really know what to say right now, but we did want to include that message of support. We will have 2 weeks from now, our next episode will be talking more in depth once we've had time to sort of think and the dust has settled a bit. We're going to be talking about some of the systemic problems that we see and some of the things that need to change and some of the issues we see with the industry. We're going to be talking about boundaries and professionalism and what it means to have boundaries and professionalism in this specific industry, which has kind of an odd culture.
Yeah, and how I think some of that culture has enabled some of the stories that have been coming forward. Not obviously we weren't personally involved in them, so we're not going to like speculate on what happened to various victims, but there's definitely stuff that both of us have witnessed that has felt like boundary problems are a big thing in this industry, and some of the broader conversations around racism are also a big deal in queer romance right now, so we want to talk about that next time.
We will be back in 2 weeks with a more in-depth sort of exploration of this. And just again, we absolutely stand with the victims and we hope everybody's taking care of themselves. And I hope you enjoy the following episode, which is definitely filled with a lot of goofs and like three different poop jokes.
Yeah, this is probably one of the goofiest episodes we've recorded in a while, which is a little maybe tonally weird with this bumper that we've added. It's my hope that if humor is the thing that helps you deal with shitty situations, which I know it is for Amanda and me, that you get some good laughs out of it and some peace and comfort, because a lot of folks need that right now.
We'll be back to talk to you soon. Everybody, and welcome back to The Hopeless Romantic. I am your host, Amanda Jean.
And I'm your other host, Austin Chant.
You're my co-host. You're my bro.
Did I create some artificial distance between us?
Well, this is the reverse of the issue we had before, where I said other host, and we were like, co-host. There's a better word for it.
Co-host. That's true. You're right. There's a whole word that English gave us.
It's what's listed on my LinkedIn, in any case. So welcome back to THR. We have a couple of fun things to talk to you about, including right now Austin and I are both wrestling with beginnings of stories, and we wanted to complain and also maybe give people some advice, but mostly complain. This is weird. I don't like doing this. You're usually the one who does it now. I'm just like, what?
Welcome to hell.
Fills dead air. But before we do that, I wanted to give you guys a couple of recommendations, because apparently one of our features of the new THR is me just telling you what books I've been reading and not really commenting on them. So let's continue that.
That's a great tradition. I love it. And then if you stick around to the end.
Oh, yeah. Our third week running of tears over some stuff.
Yeah. Nobody knows what that might be.
You know, if this is your first episode, I am sorry.
While we are in sort of this opening segment, I wanted to really quick give a shout out to something I don't think we're going to talk about in depth, but that I wanted to highlight. The Ripped Bodice just put out their 2017 statistics on racial diversity in romance publishing. It is horrible. It is profoundly bad, and I think really worth folks taking a look at to see where the holes are in the industry. I should say, their reporting, great. They've done an awesome job. They've compiled a whole lot of data, and you can find that on their Twitter.
And their website.
And their website. The Ripped Bodice is a romance bookstore, the only one, I think, in the U.S., and they are really, really rad, and they did an amazing job with this report. The statistics are devastatingly terrible.
Yeah, they're brutal. I opened them up, and the noises that came out of me were just, oh no.
Yeah, and they were bad last year. They have gotten, I think, slightly better, but in many places worse. The presses that have improved have not improved by giant leaps, and the ones that have gotten worse have gotten sometimes quite a bit worse. And I think I just wanted to highlight that because it extends across queer romance publishing as well. There were a lot of queer publishers that were among the worst in terms of their stats on diversity, in terms of racial diversity. And I think that's something that our genre needs to be super attuned to fixing and super attuned to doing outreach on. I think the publishing space that has emerged is super duper white and also doesn't tend to do a lot of aggressive outreach or promotion or intentionally racially diverse hiring. And the consequences of that are that like any press that was like founded by white folks has just sort of continued to cater to and hire and publish more white people. Industry, get it together. Take a look at that report if you hadn't. It's very good.
One of the reactions I had to that was there are so many hot takes right now on how racist and gatekeepy queer romance and romance in general is. And I am not qualified to have a hot take because I am a gatekeeper in this industry and I'm white. So there are other people who have said really important things. And I don't think anyone's necessarily come up with a solution other than if you are an author, editor, publisher in this industry, please talk about the books by authors of color that you love. Please promo those. Please put them on your lists. And please let other people know to read them. Because I think at this point that aside from aggressive outreach from companies themselves, I think that's really the only thing we can do right now.
So on the topic of books, Amanda, what have you been reading?
So I've been awful and naughty in that I'm really trying to curtail my spending on books and read the hundreds I have in my TBR. And I'm doing that. I'm making progress. However, your girl yesterday went and added like 10 books to my TBR, and then from that TBR went to Amazon and various publishers and then just bought like 5 more books. So this is sort of a one step backward, 12 steps forward. Wait, no, other way around. This is sort of a 12 steps.
That's pretty good progress you're making there.
I'm doing great. I'm good at math.
Well, that's very naughty. You've been very naughty.
But the good news is that the books that I have been purchasing and the books that I've been knocking off of my TBR have been excellent. So last episode, I mentioned that I was reading Taste of Honey by Kaya Shanti Wilson. And I have read that and the other novella in that same universe, which is called Sorcerer of the Wild Deeps. I'm going to be honest here and say that I actually enjoyed Taste of Honey more. I thought it was a cool subversion and it had a non-linear narrative and it was just a lovely piece that for me worked a little bit better than Sorcerer because Sorcerer had a voice and a narrative that was harder for me personally to parse. It had the ending was not, I don't want to spoil it.
I feel like it's not a spoiler to say that you had to Google it to figure out what was going on.
I was like, how metaphorical is this? There were moments in that book where I, who deals with unpacking symbolism in my day-to-day life, was like, is that literal? Google, Google, Google. Everyone else, was that literal? We don't know. Well, I mean, I'm glad I'm not the only one. So I really liked A Taste of Honey, but I thought that also having read Sorcerer of the Wild Deeps infused that overall world with so much more, and I thought it was a great story. It was just personally hard to parse and confusing. And then the second thing that I just read last night, which was incredible, and it is not queer, but it is a feminist response to Lovecraft's The Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith. And it has, it's like an older female protagonist who's traversing this dreamland in order to reach the sort of, at this point, semi-mythic waking land to retrieve a student who ran away. It's got like this, these really great moments of like explicit ghoulish horror and some spooky landscape stuff and a lot of really meaty information as to this main character's past. And the name of this is The Dream Quest of Villette Beau by Keyes Johnson. And I will, of course, link all of these things in the show notes. It was just beautifully written. And listen, anytime a female author beats an H.P. Lovecraft story with a stick,
yeah,
I'm for it.
That's beautiful.
So those are what I have recently finished reading. I had like a couple DNFs, did not finish. And then I'm reading like too many stories at once. Why am I this way? The worst.
Amanda, guess what I read this week?
Nothing.
Yeah.
I like how I mostly kept judgment out of my tone on that one.
I watched an episode of Queer Eye and listened to some podcasts.
Mostly, which podcasts? Also?
Mostly The Adventure Zone again.
Mm-hmm.
And Schmanners and Sawbones. None of which are books, you may notice. Before we move on, there's something that I just wanted to mention real quick. So on my Patreon, I hit a goal that I was not expecting to hit this early in the year, which is very exciting, but also a bit of a scramble because that goal was enough funding to let me dedicate time to launching a serial. So it is going to be a fantasy serial called First Singer. It is about a sort of disaster bard who is a queer trans woman and her love interest who is a big butch lady warrior and quests for vengeance and justice. I'm super duper excited about it. It's going to be free. It's funded by my Patreon, but it's going to be free. I've wanted to do something for a long time that I could put out and both make money on and have it be free for queer folks to enjoy. And everybody can read it, not just queer folks, for free.
We stand outside. Are you on the list?
Yeah. I love gatekeeping. It's like my favorite thing to do. I love to just demand to know if people are queer enough to consume my content, and if not, turn them away at the door.
What if they gate crash?
Then I jettison them into the sun, because I'm only here for pure, unadulterated queerness.
Throwing out the airlock.
If you're not above 49.8% gay,
I mean, that's how the Kinsey scale works, isn't it? It's like,
yeah.
We all know that sexuality is a very linear gradient and static.
This is all humor. It's not true. We don't believe this. Anyway, that will be launching in April, and this is absolutely not required. But if you are so inclined, you can back on Patreon, and you will get extra behind-the-scenes stuff, extra scenes, and chapters coming out pre their public launch. So that's the thing. I'm very excited. I can't wait.
Me too. I'm really thrilled. I know you've been working on that idea for a really long time.
I've been working on this particular book since before I came out as a dude, for one thing. Since I think 2013. That was when the very, very first draft of it was written, and I put it aside for a long time, and this is the first time I've seriously picked it up since then. But it's been bopping around in there for a while. I'm glad to get back to it.
Me too. Although here I'm using the eyeballs emoji, mm-hmm, and saying, hey, Austin, what does this mean for the future of the sequel to Peter Darling?
It's going to happen. See, here's the dealio. I'm happy that this happened at this time because I really needed a creative project. It had been too long since I had worked on anything creative. I have so little time right now that I'm still kind of getting used to how to carve out writing space. And working on something where it doesn't come out until I'm completely 100% done with it is so demoralizing when my pace has slowed so much. I'm excited to have this, which it's going to be a bit of work up front to get it kind of rolling, but then it'll be more of a chill thing. And I think it's going to help me get back in the zone. And then Never Never Land will be the next big thing, along with a secret project.
God, you and your 3,000 secret projects. Can't keep track.
They gotta stay secret so that I can just swap them out.
Yeah, so no one knows. Will.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, oh, actually, I didn't do that.
I know. There's so many things where I'm like, whatever happened to that thing that you mostly wrote and then you threw away? And you're like, oh, yeah, that's never going anywhere.
If it makes you feel better, remember the Dragon Slayer novella?
Yeah, you put it on Patreon.
Yeah, it's going to be a little mini serial to warm people up on Patreon.
Aww, cute. Trans
gay Dragon Slayers. So that's more Patreon content. Anyway, that's enough self promo from Austin.
Give Austin money.
Yeah.
I get to say that because I'm not him. I'm not even subscribed to your Patreon because you know why? You would just send me whatever I wanted for free.
Yeah.
This is the power I hold as your podcast producer.
Yeah, you get what you want.
I wish that were true in all elements of aspects of my life. No, I'm assertive.
Yes.
I'll make a vision board and all of my dreams will come true. You know what my current dream is?
Mm.
Going to Disneyland and staying in one of the Disney adjacent hotels in like the $5,000 a night suite that's dressed up to look like, yeah, I went down a hole the other night. I'm going to see if I can get my sugar mama, aka my best friend Macy, to
get you go a $5,000 hotel room.
Listen, we could go halvesies or she covers three.
Oh, okay. No, well, now that you've downgraded it to only $2,500, that seems totally reasonable. You're right. That was the problem. It was the full $5,000.
I know Macy, and I know that she has definitely spent at least $2,500 on something ridiculous. So maybe not all at once, though. That's kind of a hard sell.
Yeah, it might be. I don't know. Live your dreams, Amanda.
My dream is to stay in one of the fancy hotel rooms that looks like it's from a castle.
It is probably real cool. Isn't it?
It's so cool. I looked at all the pictures and
I have a requirement if you do this thing.
Hmm.
And that is that prior to staying at the fancy Disney castle, you grow your hair out really, really, really long. And then when you stay there, you throw your hair over the side of the castle so I can climb up and sneak in and hang out with you. Because I won't spend $5,000 for a hotel room, but I'll break in. I'll commit a crime in a $5,000 hotel room.
What if this is just, what if we've accidentally stumbled upon the solution here? 10 of us stay in the $5,000 a night hotel room.
10 of us is still $500 a night.
I have paid $500 a night for a hotel room before.
I haven't.
Yeah, I mean, it's an unusual thing. I'm not saying that I can do that on the reg, but I have, and it's painful. Don't do it. Listen, we're millennials. We don't have a lot of money. I have friends who can do that thing on the regular, and I'm just like, what are you? Are you a unicorn?
Yeah,
can I even look at you?
I used to have a coworker who he and his wife would go to Disneyland just like multiple times a year. Just all the time.
We should mention we're out of state.
Yeah, from Seattle.
Yeah,
which is quite a jaunt.
You know how much freaking Disney, just Disneyland passes themselves are like $110 a day. That's not including the other park. And that's not including the food in Disneyland itself. Last time I was there, I was there for like 5 hours. It was miserably hot. And I paid like $350 for a water bottle.
Yeah.
I got one of the Dole Whips and it changed my life. And I had a moment where I was sitting there eating the Dole Whip and I was just like, fuck you, Disney. Like, you've taken so many things from me. I can't even go on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride and be happy because you put Johnny Depp in it. And I'm sad, but I'm eating this Dole Whip and it's somewhat redeemed.
When me and Kizzy went to New York City Comic Con, that was the worst bottled water I've ever had. That was $4 a pop in the big convention center. Well, one of them in New York City. Anyway, I love this Disneyland content that we're adding to the podcast, but do you want to talk about beginnings and or blurbs?
Let's talk about blurbs, because I feel like beginnings is too serious for us right now. What I have long longed to do is look at blurbs for old Harlequins, you know, 70s, 80s, even 90s Harlequins. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're evocative, sometimes they're really purpley, and sometimes they are racist as fuck. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to read these blurbs and then, you know, kibitz about them and then turn them on their head and talk about how you could make them queer romance blurbs and unpack their their thornier elements.
We're not going to get into any of the, like, super duper offensive ones.
Nope. Yeah. Listen, I went on, like, 2 hours, and I'm familiar with Harlequin, so this was... I went and found, like, lists and lists and lists of classic bodice rippers, and it was depressing. I was like, how can I make any of this funny? It's horrific. Like, even some really popular authors and books that I recognize that I must have read, I was just like, ooh, God, ooh. Some of them were so bad. I was like, I can't even read this aloud. This isn't useful to anyone. And then I went and read, like, Goodreads reviews just to make sure I was understanding the blurb correctly. And they were like, oh, yeah, this is exactly as disgusting as it sounds. 5 stars. Oh. It was so sad. Oh. Would see all of these 5-star reviews and then like one person, like 1 or 2 stars, like, what's wrong with you people?
Yeah. So I think we have 4 or 5 apiece. I just grabbed, I have a stack like old Harlequins that I keep on my desk for funsies. And so maybe we could just go back and forth.
Yeah.
Just trade off.
I'll start you out with the blurb for The Fire and the Fury by author Rebecca Stratton. This was published in, I believe, the 70s or 80s. Dorcas already resented the imperious Don Julio Valderas for what he was doing to her half-brother Ramon, whom she so dearly loved. So it was more than she could bear when Valderas also started interfering with her promising friendship with Rafael Montez. Why couldn't Don Julio just mind his own business? And look...
Fucking Don Julio.
He is not... We don't need to queer this. He is fucking all of those dudes! I was reading that and I just sort of tilted my head to the left and tilted it to the right. And I was like,
so I kind of love this romance between like just an MF couple, but where they're both bi as hell. And she's just like, why is it every time I meet a dude, you're fucking him?
You're fucking my brother?
Like
my half brother?
Every time I meet a new dude who I think is all right or who is related to me, you're having sex with him.
She, like, sits him down and is like, not my dad. Anyone but my dad.
Yeah. This match can work if you keep your hands off my uncle, my father, my granddaddy.
But yeah, I enjoyed that not only was Don Julio doing... We don't know what. I mean, if we take aside the assumption that he is making sweet love to her half-brother and Rafael. So, what is he doing to Ramon? Is he blackmailing him? I need to know.
Okay. See, they've got you interested. They've got you hooked.
They got me in just a paragraph.
Yeah. All right, so I have Roses and Champagne by Betty Neals here.
Oh, that sounds good.
This is from 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Good year. And it is, it's sweet. I think it's kind of classic. Would he ever see how she truly felt? Katrina had known Lucius Massey, very close to a Malfoy there, all her life, and her childish hero worship had grown into a comfortable, warm friendship. She and Lucius had become engaged just to teach her selfish sister Virginia a lesson, nothing more. Just a dick move, but sure. She knew Lucius would never think of her as more than a friend, but as more and more people congratulated Katrina on her match, a mysterious sadness began to creep into her heart.
That's kind of sweet. Like, after all of the festival of dubious consent and racism and misogyny I looked at today with, like, the ripening bodies of young women. Oh, I have to cut that. That's too horrific.
I do want to say, I want to know from this, in what way is that teaching her sister a lesson?
I know, that's really what everything hinges on.
Any fucking excuse to get married in a romance novel. Like, bumped my knee. I might need medical insurance. Do you want to get married?
They won't let me see you at the hospital, so I'm your husband. We have to get married now. I got the priest from the chapel.
I brought the church here.
I brought the church.
I made a tiny chapel in your hospital room for your knee bruise.
Fucking, my favorite part is, like, does this extend to other people? Like, if I want to teach you a lesson, do I just marry someone?
Yeah.
Because I have no idea what the connection is between this dude, the non-Malfoy, and the sister. Like, I don't know how they know each other, if she, like, has a thing for him, what the whole situation is here, because the blurb did not see fit to tell us any of that.
No.
So I'm just like, so I could just marry anyone and it would be a lesson taught to you?
Yeah.
Not that you're my sibling, but, you know.
I really do want more queer marriage of
convenience and
marriage of convenience. It's not even really convenience because it sounds inconvenient.
Sounds deeply inconvenient.
Like fake married. I would love more queer fake married stuff, even if it does involve teaching your sibling a lesson.
An unnamed lesson. I wonder what it is, though. Like, they really did get me with that. Damn.
Yeah. Now there you go. See, they're good at this.
That's a masterful bad blurb writing. Okay, I'm gonna do Fusion by Rowan Kirby. I think this one came out in the 80s. No, I think this is the 70s. So I like this one because the tagline made me laugh for 10 minutes. It's not even that good. I'm just like, wow, they went there. She was found innocent of true love. Gina's cool demeanor and efficient manner. Wait, and
what?
Yeah, keep listening.
What?
She was found innocent of true love. Keep listening. Okay. Gina's cool demeanor and efficient manner ensured her success as a solicitor and also acted as her best defense in dissuading romantically minded suitors. An unsuccessful early marriage and the responsibilities of being a devoted single parent, saw that coming, left Gina little time or inclination to invite permanent male company. That's a great euphemism.
Permanent male company is the title of my next romance novel.
That's the sexiest description of like a male significant like other that I've ever heard.
Would you like to be my permanent male
company?
Company, baby. Baby doll.
Facebook tells you like you can put like single, it's complicated, in a domestic partnership with permanent male company. So here's the latter part of the blurb. But when an important case partnered her with wildly attractive Welsh barrister Di Reeves? Reese? Wow.
Well, Welsh names are a wash.
I don't know. Gina's passions awoke full force, and Gina's safe little world fell under close and powerfully persuasive cross-examination. The attempts at puns in this are charming. Like... Especially, again, I cannot overstate, after the truckload of awful, awful captives and sultry-eyed virgin vixens and sensual curved... Like, after that, Gina's cool demeanor and efficient manner, I was like, fuck yes!
Thank God. However, I'm still stuck on this. Found innocent of true love means she's not in love.
I mean, until she meets Welsh barrister.
I guess. But, like, that doesn't... It's not a crime, for one thing.
I know. I like how normally, it sets up this...
Why would you not say found guilty of true love as your... Why not?
At the end. Like, put that at the end. Ugh. I have a lot of questions, but I did really enjoy. And I really love how there's so many characters in cishet romance novels where the woman has somehow, like, one, been married before, and two, has a kid, and yet she's like, I've never felt a touch from a man that awakened my inner passions. And I'm just like, how did you have the kid? Like, how bad was everything before this Welsh barrister showed up?
Well, I mean, she was accused in a court of law of being in love, and they cleared her of all charges. So clearly it was pretty bad.
Well, no, maybe it was that the true love, like, it was true on her side, but not on the ex-husband's side.
I guess. Does that mean that, he went to jail for fake love, but she was proven innocent?
With someone in contempt of court.
He went to romance jail.
Also, he was a temporary male company.
Yeah.
I enjoy the sort of tame but inexplicable uses of lingo, court lingo. This is what the law is.
This is what law is.
You can definitely fall under close and powerfully persuasive cross-examination, which, by the way, how many more words could they have crammed in there?
Yeah. Guilty! See, I know how the law works, too.
I've watched so much Law and Order, I can tell you, at some point, the judge is going to hold McCoy in contempt of court.
My old job, our project managers got a gavel that they would just bang whenever we were making too much noise. It was really effective.
I want that, except I work with myself.
There's nothing like a producer just going, order! All right, so this is... Let me check the date real quick. No, it does. 1959.
Oh.
Yeah, an oldie. This is Honey by Mary Burchell.
Oh, okay.
Honey Millward, which is
the worst combination of first and last name you could ever come up with.
Who is definitely not sort of a disease. Honey Millward agreed to act as fiancé to the formidable plastic surgeon John Anston, a man she'd always regarded as a monster.
Oh my god.
The arrangement was only for the benefit of John's visiting sister, an incorrigible matchmaker. Unfortunately, his sister's visit looked like it might be permanent, and to complicate matters even further, Honey found herself falling in love with him.
I have so many questions, right? Like, what the fuck is going on in these people's ultra complicated lives where
also,
they're like,
she regards him as a monster, and then in the second sentence she's like, oh yeah, but when your sister's here, I'll pretend to be your fiance. I don't know about
it's
you.
Weird. That's honestly just buck wild and weird. I don't understand anything that happened, except I know that I will cherish Honey's last name. What is it?
Millward.
God.
The next one, actually, that I have has an even better name, but I'll let you toss one at me first.
This is called The Taming. It's the first in the Cameron series. It's by Aileen Malcolm.
Cameron is not a good name for a series.
No, I was thinking that too. I was like, that's a choice.
This is my new series, John. Book one. John, book one.
Everyone
Things is so easy.
I don't know why authors are always all het up about it.
Yeah.
Oh my god, the best part of this. Oh, I just realized. Oh, Austin, the best part of this.
Oh, okay. Tell me.
As wild as the whipping sea wind, .. was Cameron.
Okay.
Beautiful, innocent, shameless. What?
What?
A spark of Scotland's blazing past. With the pure, unspoiled spirit of a child.
No.
This is the one that gets really bad.
Okay.
And the ripening womanhood of a temptress.
No. I
pictured a banana. She was an irresistible challenge to every man who met her. Four ellipses.
What does that mean?
As strong and proud as the Scottish coast was Alex, the dashing son of a Highland warrior. Tormented by a tragic past, he had vowed to live only for today. Until that windswept night when the emerald-eyed, fiery-spirited Cameron charged into his world atop a rearing black stallion, four ellipses.
Okay, that's pretty badass.
Yeah, I like that. I like that she came in there on a black stallion. Together they crossed the Scottish Isle from the raw, sea-worn cliffs and endless moors to the lavish mirrored halls of Edinburgh? What is it?
Edinburgh.
Okay, I'm taking that over again. Together they crossed the Scottish Isle from the raw, sea-worn cliffs and endless moors to the lavish, mirrored halls of Edinburgh's high society. Together they plunged toward the inevitable moment that would rule their lives forever and carry their hearts to the rapturous brink of The Taming, the immortal tale of a man and woman who dared to share a dangerous love, a reckless destiny. I don't understand why this is a dangerous love or a reckless destiny. I don't
know. I was going to say, gives new meaning to the phrase, fuck you and the horse you rode in on. Although, I take it back, you didn't fuck the horse. I love this manic pixie Scottish girl. Like,
Banana. How is she beautiful, innocent, and shameless? Like, I get that shameless may not necessarily have to do with, like, sexuality or her body.
She's quirky. Quirky is what that means.
She's just precocious. I don't know. She's just...
Means she dyes her hair and rides a motorcycle and... Yeah.
In, like, 1763.
Yeah, you know, the equivalent. Whenever the horse is the motorcycle.
I don't actually know when this is set. That's the best part of this, is just... This could be completely contemporary, or it could be, like, again, the 18th century or something. Who knows? Because it mentions a spark of Scotland's blazing past. Okay. When? The only clue... is that she charges into his world atop the black stallion of fame and lore. And then they hang out in high society, which kind of implies... I mean, I guess Scotland still has high society, but I just can't see that being as important in contemporary fiction. I'm so curious about The Taming and what else is in store for the Cameron series. I'm going to go look up and see what other books are. There's three. The second one is Ride Out the Storm.
Okay.
Ooh, this is good. Ooh. Reckless in the face of danger, Cameron plunged through the night, no longer a child, not yet a woman.
God damn it.
Coal black hair flying, emerald eyes blazing, her lithe body at one with the raging elements and speeding stride of her bold black stallion. This horse has just a bigger of a role.
Is this a blurb?
Yes! Hold on, what? I'm not done. Shameless in her desire, for Alex, her proud Highland warrior, yet willing to play the lady for his sake, she returned to somewhere in Scotland that I can't pronounce to find their ancestral halls, their very marriage bed, usurped by the hated English.
Jesus Christ.
Rebellious, blind to risk, Cameron would strike out at insult and injury. She would flee Scotland for a savage new world. That's a great combination of words there that aren't loaded. Defying the man who claimed her, the man who would follow and find her, who swore to tame her, and with her ride out the storm. Okay, that's number two.
Okay.
And then I will end this with the daughters of Cameron. Oh, this is bad. Oh, it's bad. Okay. Passion was their legacy.
Okay.
Behind them lay the American wilderness, ravaged by war, gripped by savagery.
No.
I think that's the only really fucked up thing in this. Before them rose Scotland's stormy cliffs and the promise of reclaiming their proud ancestral estate, their bold heritage. Sultry, sun-kissed Kestrel, an exquisite raven-haired Rue. Together they had seen what no woman was meant to see, and steeled themselves to trust no one. Only men as strong as Nick McKay, as fearless as the dark pirate Hawk, could hope to penetrate the proud fortress of their hearts. For in their blood raced the fiery spirit of the Black Cameron, legendary Highland beauty. Like their mother before them, they were untamed, reckless in danger, destined to love one man and one man only, rapturously, passionately, and forever. This is the final book in the Cameron trilogy. You know what I appreciate about that? Aside from the
that it's over.
That's over. But also that I presume that since this is the sequel about her kids, that we get to see an older Cameron, which is rare. Like, you don't usually see the heroine of a romance novel older.
Do you think she's a woman yet?
She only becomes a woman when her fucking horse dies. It's a rite of passage.
Oh, wow. It's a sad rite of passage.
I took it dark. Oh, God. All right. Do you have one for me so that we can put Cameron and her daughters to bed?
One of these is interesting. I realized I'm not sure it's technically a romance. I think it might be a pre-romance.
No.
It was published in 1936.
Nice.
Which I believe puts it pre-Harlequin.
Yeah, it is.
It is a bantam, but it's definitely in the tradition. The tagline is the playboy and the stable girl.
Yes.
The inside cover is Townie Middleton was mad about horses. He bet on them, rode them, and raced them. He liked everything about horses, including the stables, the stable man, and of course, the stable man's beautiful daughter.
Oh my God, for a minute I was like, wait, is this queer?
Not quite. Although, gosh. I would be into this premise if it was like, and his sexy stable boy. The back of the book says Townie Middleton, which is, again, a great name, was the poorest millionaire in 48 states, the most poverty-stricken country squire who ever tried to juggle a large estate, a racing stable, and sky-high life on absolutely nothing per annum. But even if he didn't have a cent, Townie had plenty of trouble. Women. Expenses. Women. Worries. And women.
Wow, Townie.
Topsy was a stable... was a chorus girl.
Jesus!
Topsy Townie was a chorus...
Topsy! Townie
Wait,
is Topsy!
Wait, no, hang on. That's not the... I don't think that's the love interest. Topsy was a chorus girl, and she loved him. Sally was a Southern belle, and she adored him.
Okay.
Boots was a stable girl, and she worshipped him. Something had to happen, and everything did.
I love that ending so much. Also, this reminds me of the, like, drill tweet where it's like, help me with my budget, my family is dying, and it's like $1,000 a month on candles.
Yeah.
This is $1,000 a month on boots and Topsy and the other one.
Also, this book has like three blurbs in it. This is another one. There's another one inside the front. There's two inside the front cover on alternating pages. Yeah, it's definitely the stable girl. He spent his love on chorus girls, Southern belles, gold diggers, and assorted ladies on the make. He thought that was the one thing he'd really used up until he found out about the fighting heart of a beautiful stable girl. I love this, and I want it to be gay. I would read the fuck out of this as a queer romance.
You love your Playboy characters. Especially
I do.
Your
I love
useless,
them. I just want this,
ones.
Like, I want a useless, broke Playboy, not millionaire, with too much stuff,
who falls in love with a stable boy who probably, like, owns him.
I hope that stable boy, like, steps on him.
Yeah, that's the only way. And his name is Boots.
Yes!
Just to perfect. Really grind it in there.
No pun intended, yet every pun intended.
I think that wraps us up.
I think that wraps us up, except to take a page from our favorite Mackle boys. You want a Yahoo?
Yes. Are we doing are we stealing from the Bim Bam now?
Yeah, fully and completely. All props to my brother and me for this idea, but I thought it would be funny to see if anyone had any bizarre questions on Yahoo Answers about romance novels, and I found this. Sickness after reading romance novels? ? This is by Anonymous. After I read a romance novel, I have a weird feeling. I start to have breathing problems. I start to feel kind of dizzy. I don't know what is going on. You're horny. Followed by best answer. Somebody wrote like a really cute Tuft wrote a cute little response that they were like, wow, I additionally love Gone with the Wind, Austin Sparks, and the Brontes. I love the next books, and I suppose you must take a look at them, as it kind of feels we've an identical style. The missing manuscript, like, there's literally just a list, and it includes The Fault in Our Stars and Anna Karenina, which feels like two very different genres. Also, Steinbeck.
Sure.
Hemingway?
If you enjoyed Nora Roberts, why don't you move straight on to Anna Karenina?
Karenina.
Karenina. There we go.
So the best answer from Speed Madness Flying Saucers 7 years ago. Ooh. It could be either two things, spelled T-O-O. You have read an old book that has acquired a mold that has mildly psychoactive qualities, and you inadvertently absorb some through you skin, causing the problems, or the content of the romantic novel has caused the superego, that part of your psyche that handles executive functions, is reeling from the idiotic lack of reality when you compare your own life with the doubtless fantastic story of love you just read. It continues... I always believed that girls had a disadvantage with romance. They are groomed to expect it, to elicit it, to revel in it, when in reality a true relationship does not require your lover bringing you breakfast in bed, but a meeting of the minds and hearts. This is a Redditor. Just as they're subliminally taught that their personal worth is based on their looks and sexiness, two things that just... They spelled two correctly this time, that disappear in a couple decades or so. At any rate, I've often wondered if young, impressionable women didn't pursue relationships framed with the myth of romance and were horribly disappointed when they find out that men need to use the toilet on a regular basis and were not wired for violins, flowers, and Cupid starting about after the initial euphoria of love wears a bit. One, shut this person up.
As we know, if you piss in your life ever, you cannot then romance a person. You're done.
I'm frankly reeling. I don't know if it's the mold from the old books that I read, but do men shit? I can't believe my entire life I was lied to.
One of the hardest parts of transitioning, actually, was the shitting.
Book about it.
It took me a really long time to get used to that aspect of manhood.
When you get like tea, do they give you a pamphlet for the tea and also a pamphlet on how to effectively void?
A weird new thing is gonna happen to you.
Changes you may notice in your body.
Second puberty was wild.
Oh my fucking god. Everything about this best answer from Speed Madness Flying Saucers made me really sad for them. Women are too stupid to know that your romance isn't really a lover bringing you breakfast and bread, which, fuck yourself.
Some people, in fact, do bring each other breakfast in bed, and like, if that's what you want in a relationship, there's nothing wrong with being like, hey, I would love it if we brought each other breakfast in bed. Wow. That was easy.
The toast drops out of your mouth. You're like, men shit.
I just feel like anybody who sits around being like, why don't you make your expectations for romance realistic? Nobody will treat you like this. Like, okay, well, I know you won't. Thanks for identifying yourself as someone who thinks, like, bringing your partner breakfast in bed is a completely unreasonable expectation.
What do you mean you want to eat with me?
God, you want me to treat you nicely? Welcome to the real world. I'm an asshole. Like, oh, okay.
I also love that they started out presumably attempting to answer the question scientifically, and then it just devolved into their, like, semi-MRA rant about how brainwashed women are by the notion of romance. I've learned
on
a lot today.
Yeah, we've educated ourselves a lot, and now it's time to educate our listeners.
It's time to...
Kinda. I actually, that's not a great intro to this, because I don't know how educational this will be, but let's try. So, beginnings. Beginnings of books.
Yes.
This came up for me today just because I have been wrestling again with the beginning of a book and realizing how frequently that's the hardest part for me. Enough time on this show has been devoted to how much struggle I had with Peter Darling. I'm now wrestling with my serial all over again, just trying to figure out what is the good first place to drop in. I have a much easier time with endings personally because it's easy for me to sit down and be like, where do I want this story to end? And kind of be like, well, what would be most satisfying for me with these characters? Where do I want us to go together? And what's a good, like, ending shot? But then to work backwards from that to the opening shot is where I tend to flounder. I did a very scientific poll today on Twitter.com. I'm just going to check those numbers.
I
really
voted
quick.
In that poll.
You voted in the poll.
Which means you know
beginning.
It's legit. It's peer-reviewed.
Mm-hmm. That is what peer-reviewed means. Of 96 votes, it is 56% for beginnings over endings as the most difficult part to write, with a few stray votes for middles.
I didn't even see middles was an option because, like, fuck
that. Oh, it's not. It wasn't, but a couple people noted that they have a harder time with that.
I think everyone has fallen into the endless slog of the middle, the wasteland. Yeah, but that's easy to trim. Like, you can definitely tighten middles. Beginning set the tone and set the sort of beginning of the Rube Goldberg machine in action. So if you don't get that right, you have trouble, at least I do, seeing how everything will unravel from then. And if you change one of the things that unravels, you inevitably have to change the beginning as well. Well, maybe not. But for me, that's what happens, is like I start out and I'm like, yes, I have decided what my beginning will be and it seems to be working. And then halfway through, I'm like, oh, no, I have to go back and revise. This isn't the right place to start.
What made it click for me with this particular one, I think... Let's not put a pin in that.
Yeah.
Like, but what helped for me today was to sit down, because I tend to get clear on my endings relatively early on now. That's something I've realized I need to do. Be like, what do I want to be the place where this... What's going to be a very satisfying ending that I can always be working toward?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of did the same thing for the beginning, where instead I was just like, what do I want this story to feel like? Because I think... that's going to be really important. I want people to know immediately. I mean, I want the beginning to be generally good, but I also want it to be like, you know what you're getting into from this.
Yeah.
So I sat down and literally meditated on my lunch break.
What has this job done to you?
My job is putting me in a weird place. I was meditating inside one of the focus pods that we have in my work. I have a weird tech job now. And I can't say much about it, but yeah, we have little focus pods that you can go into, and they've got kind of like mood lighting, and they're noise isolating.
I think those are jerk-off pods for some people, frankly.
Okay. I mean, I hope not in my workplace. I think most people use them for phone calls, but...
That's what you think.
So I went and just sat down and like thought about what makes me happy about this story. What are the pieces of it that I'm most enthused to write? What are kind of the, like, the big overall pieces that are going to fall into place? And I went, like, really vague in terms of, like, the things that came to mind were I want it to be funny. And I want it to evoke D&D tropes. And so it was, like, dungeon crawling, funny, but also kind of grim, like occult vibes was definitely in there. And then looked at what I had written and was like, well, cool, none of those things are there. I'm getting better at following my instincts on if something feels boring, it's not because I'm not working hard enough, it's probably because it's bad. And there's something to uncover there. And what I found was that the openings that I had written were fine on a technical level. Like, my prose was no worse than usual or anything, but they were not actually hitting any of those beats. The only relation they had to what I wanted the story to be was that they had the characters in them.
Yeah.
The characters of the book were there, and it did more or less set up like the beginning of the main arc, but it didn't satisfy emotionally how I wanted that to land. I tossed it, and I came up with something that I think does at least hit all of those beats that I can get excited about in the same breath that I'm getting excited about the ending, because it's tied in a lot better.
I want to talk about endings in a future episode, because I think those are also really hard to nail for people, myself yeah. included, because I'm currently trying to write a novella/novel, we'll find out, because I have the impulse control of nothing and bought a pre-made cover that I thought was really pretty. And then I was like, well, now I need to write a story to go with this. And I've been plotting and throwing ideas at people and workshopping it. And I have a general idea of the story and the beats I want to hit and the world building. But I'm coming up against that place where some of these things I need to figure them out by writing them. And I don't think that outlining this in great detail will do anything except exhaust me. So I'm, you know, stumbling up against my own energy and like, do I want to sit down and do this? Do I want to not? And then getting ahead of myself because I understand what I need to look for structurally in it on a really meta level. And I need to divorce my editor brain from my writer brain here and just write. But I did want to...
editor's curse.
The editor's fucking curse, man. But I did want to talk about some of the things I notice as an acquisitions editor is the mistakes people make with beginnings and the same things that I struggle with. A lot of times what I will end up seeing when I open up a manuscript that's just been sent through Slush is pages of narrative that are character voice, backstory, scene setting, stuff like that. And even if it's super well written, nothing is happening. Like, the character is going over here, the character is going over there, the character is thinking about this, the character is reflecting. That's not anything. It doesn't matter yeah. how well it's written. And even if you have them interacting with other characters, you know, there could be banter, there could be whatever, nothing is happening because you don't have a hook and you don't have an inciting incident. And if you're submitting a story or if you're going back and revising a story, you need to make sure that in your first page and in your first chapter, you have a hook followed by an inciting incident. And a hook is the question that you want the audience or the reader to ask themselves. I'll give an example with the story I'm working on now. And I think the question for right now, this is what I'm planning. God knows it could change later. The question right now I'm asking is, who killed the necromancer? Who or what killed the necromancer? And you'll notice that question is not, why did someone or something kill the necromancer? Or another version of those things. But like, that is what I want the audience to be invested in solving the mystery to. Should be introduced early. It should almost be introduced immediately. It could be first scene, the first action that happens on screen, or even the first line if you're skilled enough. Then, after you've got the hook set up, you need the inciting incident. It's usually when something world-shattering happens. Shit hits the fan, basically. One of the things that people fall into a trap with re-inciting incidents is confusing them with the moment when in the first act when your character like decides to go do something and chase a different goal, or like where they proactively react to a situation. Wow, is that a thing you can do? Where they proactively decide to go on a journey. It's usually like a call to action or whatever. And an inciting incident is just when the world is shaken. It's when the plane crashes. It's when Spider-Man gets bit by the radioactive spider. It is not when Spider-Man decides to be Spider-Man. That is different. So your inciting incident and your hook need to be as immediate as you can make them. And if I see in your story that you have something resembling a hook and an inciting incident and they are different, I will probably keep reading, frankly. I generally try to finish the manuscripts that I read in Slush, but some of them you just know. I'll read the first two chapters and then I'll skim toward like the latter third of the manuscripts. And if it doesn't have the beats that it needs, it's going to be a no. You definitely need these things to encourage people to keep reading, especially the submissions.
Yeah, I was going to say, if somebody... is not doing the work of hooking you in the first two chapters, frankly, it's generous to keep reading because readers mm-hmm. won't. Readers
no,
are going to be done
thing.
Pretty damn early if you're not hooking them.
That's one of the reasons why I personally don't really enjoy prologues or long preambles. I really don't like to sift through material that isn't the hook or isn't mm-hmm. the inciting incident. Sometimes they work really well, but you have to be extremely adept with how you write them, and they have to be tied in to something sort of earth-shattering.
I think a prologue needs to be the hook.
I think it can be.
Or a hook.
Yeah.
Like, a hook about something. I have issues with A Song of Ice and Fire sort of in general, but one thing I will say for it is George R. R. Martin is one of the best writers I know at writing prologues and epilogues.
Yeah.
Because they're always information you can't get elsewhere.
Yeah.
They're not just there as a, like, preview of action to come later. Mm-hmm. They're always interesting, and they always are suspenseful in their own way.
I usually recommend people cut it, because one of the major issues I see in submissions is that people don't know where their story starts. There's some adage I read somewhere that's like, the first 50 pages can be cut. Like, usually authors don't find their footing until 50 pages in. And sort of that is the building and the sort of trial and error that you do when you're writing a draft is, like, you put it all on the page. And then maybe sometimes you don't have the objectivity to sit back and go, you don't actually need this first chunk, this first chapter. In some cases, that's the prologue. I rarely read a prologue and I'm like, oh, yes, this revved me. This is what I needed. Yeah. And prologues are so frequently like these narrative chunks where they're just nothing's happening. It's just like once upon a time in the land of da-da-da-da-da. Unless you're telling me that a dragon came and lit everything on fire, I don't care. Just cut it. Just take
or
it away.
It'll be the equivalent of like, hey, don't worry. The beginning of this book is about to be really boring, but here's a snippet of the action that will happen later.
That happens so much. Oh my god, the prologue just being like engaging, intense, and then it cuts to like someone walking down a country lane thinking.
Yep.
I want to put my head through a screen because I can see, like, you understand that you want to get the audience interested in your characters and your world, but you fall into the trap of like, well, I think I need to scene set and I think I need to introduce this character. Yeah, you do. But the ways that you do that are through establishing what their goals are and how the inciting incident is shaking up their world. You don't do it by being like, here, I will show them, like, in calm 5-page meandering situation where they go about their daily tasks, unless you're telling me something so deeply important and so compelling that I have to keep reading. That, frankly, rarely do the twain meet.
Yeah, like, all advice is relative, but I feel like that's a pretty solid one, is like, please give people a reason to be excited about the start of your book.
Yeah.
That isn't just...
It's a book.
The beginning of the book in and of itself should be exciting and engaging, not just because something interesting will happen later and you're getting them ready for it. Like, start us where
it gets interesting.
Start us at the interesting part.
The hook in the inciting incident should be the interesting part. This is where I was falling into the same thing. Like, I was talking to my friend Iba about, she's a master of structure in ways that I'm not. And she thinks a lot, but she doesn't overthink the way that I do, where I just like come up with an idea and I reject it kind of out of hand because I'm like, well, that won't work because of X, Y, Z down the line. She's just like, what if I give you this wacky idea? And I'm like, ah, shit, that works. The idea I have for this story was, different when I was explaining it to her. And she says, well, why don't you have the necromancer die in the prologue? Like, we should see the necromancer alive first. And I was like, but I don't want to write a prologue ever. Me, the hater, doesn't want to write a prologue. And then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, oh, she's right. I have to write a prologue.
Yeah, that was the problem I was having too. I was having, and I think hopefully I fixed this now, I have three main protagonists in my serial. And one of them, in the very, very beginning, doesn't have a whole lot going on. She has, like, a lot going on in her backstory, but she's kind of at the moment where she's going to be swept up in something.
Mm-hmm.
But the other two have a lot of shit going on. And in order to, like, bring them into alignment, I was trying to do, like, I was basically derailing the other two in ways that just didn't make any sense for, like... They've got shit to do.
Yeah.
They're not going to be pausing to initiate an adventure with some rando. They're on their way to important shit in their lives. And so I shuffled it around so that the important shit they were doing was related. And
shocking.
It was all part of the same narrative and not like a random side quest to get them acquainted. Because I'm excited about this and I hope it... I can pull it off. I did want to do the classic like D&D opening where they have like a weird mini campaign just to get acquainted.
Yeah.
I want to do that, but I was like, okay, but it needs to actually be tied into the plot in a big, exciting way. So I think it feels a lot better. Like, I'm actually excited about it for the first time. Whereas before, it was just like, okay, I'm going to get through this, and then I can get to the stuff I'm psyched about.
Yeah.
Now I'm, like, pumped to write the beginning of the book, and that's how it should be.
Yeah. If you find it exciting, maybe not interesting, because goodness knows, sometimes I found some really navel-gazing stuff I've written is interesting, and it's not, objectively. If you find it exciting, if you're jazzed to write it, I have a feeling that audiences will respond to it better. I described the inciting incident as being when the character is aware of the world changing around them. The first act turning point is when they have irrevocably placed themselves on the road toward whatever goal they're heading toward, right? There's a difference between the inciting incident and the turning point, which I think some authors make it confused. Is like, oh, well, the world has changed and Frodo's on the road to...
Amathanen. Yeah.
Nerds.
Sorry, go on.
Kate Blanchett whispers in the dark. feel it in the earth. I smell it in the air. So I feel like authors may be confused about the difference between an inciting incident and the turning point because they're all in the first act. I would say the first act change comes maybe 25% in. It can come earlier, it can come later, but it's basically, you know, dun, 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 Frodo's hit the road to Mordor, but we need the reason why they've decided to do this. It's not just enough that Frodo was given the ring. I feel like that is, for him, the inciting incident. Given the ring, Bilbo, you know, hops away, disappears. He doesn't literally hop, although that's a really cute image. Bilbo hops to Rivendell. There's the moment that makes Frodo decide to do this, right? Austin, what do you think the moment is where he decides to hit the road to go to Mordor? Like, what makes him change his mind?
Well, there's the ring wraiths was my immediate thought.
Yep.
it's the sort of imminent death.
Yeah, it's the personal threat to him, because, like, it's one thing to know that the ring isn't safe, and it's one thing to know that there's something going on in the world. It's another thing to be like, oh, this is threatening, like, my home.
It's the Shire Baggins, but that will lead them here.
Yep.
Line. Where he goes from, like, oh, look at this scary ring, what a bad story Gandalf is telling me, to get out the door, run, pack my bags, I gotta go.
So we can track, like, obviously, so the inciting incident is when he gets the ring. The key event is when the ring wraiths happen and he's like, oh, holy shit, everything's bad and I gotta do something about it. And then the first act change and turning point is when he is on the road to Mordor. This shit starts to get wild.
When we say the road to Mordor, do we mean the road to Rivendell?
We mean the road to Rivendell. I just mean, okay, like, the overarching theme of, like, okay, Frodo's going on this quest and journey.
Because you also have, like, definitely an act change when they leave Rivendell to go to Mordor. But that is, nobody cares. Austin, shush.
And that's also the second act turn in just the first book/movie.
Yeah.
It's hard with a trilogy, too, because there's so many. It's like, okay, well, it's like, I guess the first act of the trilogy is the first book.
Yeah. I'm doing kind of a fun thing with First Singer, my serial, in that I decided to do mini arcs rather than books because I'm writing a web serial and...
It's harder to...
Who cares? Cares.
Do what you want.
Like, I don't need to do a 3-book structure for a trilogy. I originally envisioned it as a trilogy, but then I kept wanting to do shorter. I wanted to do more stories and shorter ones. So I'm going to try this thing out where I just do, I think, roughly 25K, like, novella-ish arcs where that will be all part of a big overarching story, but those mini arcs will kind of contain their own little stories, and they'll be semi-self-contained. I'm kind of hyped about it.
I'm hyped for you, too. Hold on, sorry. I was looking at a website earlier that's, like, this really cool resource for authors where they have a story structure database where they break down the inciting incidents, first plot points, pinch points, midpoints, etc. for popular books and movies. And I was like, I wonder if they agreed with me about the inciting events in the Fellowship. And I was right. Although it's the book and not the movie, so there are slight differences. But yeah, it's definitely he leaves the possessions to Frodo and Bilbo leaves. And Gandalf is like, this ring is the one ring of power. Ah!
That's a good Gandalf impression.
Bilbo Baggins. Do not take me for some conjurer of cheap tricks. Wow, that, I don't know what that was.
Yeah, that was a good...
It was not a good handoff.
I was impressed.
But I'll link the website to...
Sir Ian McKellen, are you in the room with me?
I am here. That's the fucking worst. Still better acting than the acting in The Hobbit, though.
Well...
Through no fault of his own.
In the twilight of this episode, this will be, a shorter crying segment than usual.
Yeah, we gotta wrap this up.
Because this is ground that we have covered a few times. But Amanda, you have now been listening to The Adventure Zone. Do you want to share the emotions that you've been having?
Yep. I mean, no, because hell. But, so, if you listen to the first, the previous two episodes, it was a slow unfurling of Austin having listened to the balance arc of The Adventure Zone and me having been way far behind him and just sort of chiming in and being like, oh, yeah, you know, it's cute and fun, I like it, and I know it's gonna hurt later. It hurts later. It hurts real bad. Guys, it hurts. It hurts so bad that I'm, like, in my fucking bed, like, beating my pillow, just like, why?
It is really, really legitimizing for me because I know I am a baby.
I haven't cried yet, baby. Though.
I'm a crybaby and, like, not very smart when it comes to, like, plot twists. Mm. So having Amanda also react and be like, I'm really emotional and also what a twist. Very validating for me.
Yeah, it was funny. Like, also, I'm excited to. I was looking over our chat log, and I had, like, so accurately guessed some of the things, like our little conversation, where I was like, I think this is this. I was pretty right across the board. Some of it I couldn't have guessed.
And this is maybe another writing lesson that we can take forward. I've taken a lot of writing lessons forward from The Adventure Zone, yeah. But one that I think is good for this is, like, For pulling off plot twists, they do a really good job of withholding an essential piece of information that would allow you to make sense of the clues.
Yeah.
So that you don't actually... You have enough to wonder and you have enough to make... To theorize and to make those kind of fun guesses, but you're withholding a piece of knowledge that makes it all kind of fall into place.
I mean, that's really the only way to successfully hide information from your... Oh my god, what am I even saying anymore? God knows. I'm still stuck on do men shit. I can't call this episode that, unfortunately.
Do men shit.
This is the weirdest fucking episode we've done in a while. I did a bad Gandalf, and we screamed about men shitting, and,
I mean, it's you think it's weird now. Imagine me when I first shat for the first time at age 20. It was a wild experience.
It was life-changing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you just felt a lot lighter.
Am I doing it right? Is it always like this?
Back to Taz and Griffin's incredible way of withholding a really key piece of information that, like, I had kind of guessed... Like, I had guessed bits and pieces around it, right? Like, I was like, well, this piece of information is probably related to this. And I was right there, but I had no idea how, and I had no idea how everything else slotted in around that. And I was like, holy shit, Griffin, when I found out.
It's a really good, really interesting, and, like, satisfying way of having stuff revealed to you, where you're like, it is that feeling of, like, turning around and then being like, oh, there's the missing mm-hmm. piece, and then the whole image suddenly takes on a new shape because the twist is that big. Part three of our pitch for other people to listen to The Adventure Zone because it's very good.
And I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about this one because it's a little bit different. I was going to talk a little bit more about the balance arc, and now I can't remember what I was going to say aside from I love Taco. I mean, I love everybody, but Taco the shitty gay wizard elf.
Just the best. The representation I want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Shitty queer character. Shitty,
give
like...
Give me the shitty queer characters.
Shitty, like, femme-coded queer characters.
Hmm.
Ugh. I'm actually... I have a lot of feelings about, like, femme queer people, especially, like, femme queer men or mask-coded mm-hmm. people. And I'm actually writing a fucking research paper on a femophobia in the queer community, especially amongst cis gay men. So I'm just like, any time I'm fed from the plate of taco, I'm just like, yes. I'm legitimately trying to think if there's a way I can cite like as an example of like like a femme-coded queer dude. I wonder if I can. I bet you I can bullshit my way into this.
Absolutely you can.
What other reason is there to write a paper you don't want to write?
I quoted fanfic in my senior thesis.
That's legit.
Do whatever you want.
I've definitely titled papers after Kanye West lyrics, which is kind of a, yeah. It's, I feel like that's a 101 move, but also you have to have some confidence to carry that off. I also accidentally once submitted, I was submitting a paper that I was originally calling gay in Nazi Germany, and then I was like, no, I should call it queer in Nazi Germany. And I accidentally fucked up and submitted a paper called gay.
Good.
I got an A+ on it, but I still, every time I look at that, because I'm going to have to send it in for a portfolio thing, every time I look at it, I'm just like, ugh, I have to send in gay by Amanda Jean.
Yeah.
Which, if there's anything more emblematic of me and my academic career, I don't know what it would be.
That's just about as accurate as you can get.
Also, we have some great new news that you may have missed if you are not following us on Twitter, which you should do. We are now on Spotify, so if you want to listen to THR via Spotify, go do that. We would appreciate it. And also, it looks really cool in the Spotify interface when I go back.
It looks great.
Yeah, it looks great. When I go back and listen to THR episodes, which I do sometimes, I listen to it through Apple Podcasts, so I'm so used to that that seeing it in Spotify was like, oh, what's this?
Yeah, it's rad.
And if, as always, if you want to continue this conversation about a myriad topics, you can
harder than it sounds, isn't
you
it?
You can yell into the night. We'll hear you.
Yeah,
my ears.
If you'd like to continue this conversation, don't add us. Just scream.
Open up your door and just yell, Bilbo Baggins.
Do at us. We love to hear from you.
Yes. I can be found on Twitter at Amanda H. Jean.
And I can be found at Austin Chanted.
And that's our show. Take care, everybody.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFora and Amanda Jean, with art by Keezy Young and music by Carly Ann Warden. If you want to continue the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, follow us on Facebook, check out our Patreon, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.